Stop, Go, Stop, episode 192, Motion, Moving, and No One Owns It. It starts with a spark, a small thing, barely there. Just a flicker of heat, of energy, but it's enough. Enough to ignite the mix of air and fuel waiting in the chamber. Enough to turn that tiny explosion into movement. The spark plug fires, the gas combusts, the piston drives down, the crankshaft turns, a rhythm, a cycle, intake, compression, power, exhaust, over and over, small explosions pushing metal, pushing force, pushing everything forward. That's all an engine is, controlled fire. Heat and pressure tamed just enough to make something move. But it has to be precise. Too much air, and the fire stutters, weak. Too much gas, and it floods, chokes, drowns itself. Everything needs balance, timing, a harmony of things unseen. And the oil, God, the oil is everything. It keeps the metal from grinding itself to dust, keeps the movement smooth, keeps the heat from turning the whole thing into a locked-up mess of ruined parts. The wrong oil, the wrong viscosity, and the engine wears down, piece by piece, until one day it just stops. Most people don't think about it. They turn the key, they press a button, and it starts. Magic, like breathing, like heartbeat. They only notice when something goes wrong, when the rhythm breaks, when the spark doesn't catch, when the fire dies. The heart of it all, the cylinders. That's where the magic happens, where the fire burns. Each one is a chamber, a tiny furnace. The pistons move up and down inside them, driven by the explosion set off by the spark plugs. And holding it all together? The engine block, solid metal, heavy as hell, built to take heat, pressure, everything the world throws at it. You crack that, and it's over. Might as well bury the whole car. Then there's the intake manifold, the lungs. It pulls in air, feeds it into the cylinders, mixes it with fuel. You can smell when it's off, too much gas, and there's this thick, unburnt stench that lingers, seeps into your clothes. Not enough air, and it struggles, wheezes like a smoker's last breath. The fuel injectors, tiny nozzles, delicate but essential, they spray the gas in fine mist, perfect for ignition. A clogged injector, and you can feel it in the hesitation, in the uneven rhythm of acceleration, and you can smell it too, raw fuel, sharp, biting. A warning. The serpentine belt snaking through, connecting power to motion. It drives the alternator, the water pump, the power steering. When it starts to wear, it smells like burning rubber, like something slipping just before it snaps. And the exhaust, the final breath. The pipes carry away the waste, the spent fuel turned to heat, to carbon, to the invisible ghost of every explosion that kept the engine alive. A rich, dark smell when it's running right, acrid, rotten, when something's failing deep inside. You can stand here, close your eyes, breathe in, and know what's wrong before you even touch a tool. A modern engine barely feels like an engine anymore. You pop the hood, and what do you see? Plastic, covers hiding the real parts, wires running to sensors that talk to computers, not mechanics. You don't fix things with your hands anymore. You plug in a scanner, let it tell you what's wrong. And half the time, you don't repair. You replace. The machine doesn't trust you to understand it, so it keeps its secrets locked behind code. Now take a Model A Ford, nothing hidden. No sensors, no computers, just metal, gears, bolts, and gasoline. A real engine, something you could understand just by looking at it. Four cylinders, a simple carburetor, gravity-fed fuel system, no high-pressure injectors, no electronics deciding how much gas you get. You turn the crank, you set the timing by ear, you listen to the sound of the machine and adjust it as needed. It was rough, loud, it shook like hell, rattled every bone in your body. The whole car felt alive because it wasn't smoothed out by 100 layers of insulation and electronic dampening. When you pressed the gas, you felt it. No power steering, no hydraulic brakes, just you, muscle, and metal. And the smells. A Model A had the deep, rich scent of raw mechanics. Oil that seeped into every seam. Gasoline with lead in it, thick and sharp. Exhaust that hung in the air, unfiltered, unapologetic. You smelled the road in those cars. Dust, grease, the faint burning scent of metal on metal. Now, modern cars don't even smell like cars anymore. Synthetic oil, plastic interiors, air-conditioned sterility. The exhaust is scrubbed clean by catalytic converters. The fuel burns leaner, controlled, precise. Good for the world, sure, but there's something missing. A Model A was a machine you could fix with a wrench and a sense of patience. A modern car is a black box, whispering in binary, waiting for you to hand it over to someone with a laptop and a service manual written in code. Maybe that's progress. Maybe it's just the price of moving forward. Moving forward. Always moving. You might say, a Model A. I thought the Model T was the famous one. It was. But the A, it was sleeker. It was a step up from the T, but not too much of a step up. Henry Ford had a vision. Make a car that anyone could afford, a machine for the people, not just for the rich, not a toy for the elite, but something that a farmer, a factory worker, a shopkeeper could own. That was the whole idea. A car wasn't supposed to be a luxury. It was supposed to be a tool. So he kept it simple, even his Model A, simple compared to what came next. But the Model A could be a hot rod. It could be a simple car. It all depended what you did with it. The Model A wasn't built to impress. It was built to last. A four-cylinder engine, 40 horsepower. Enough to get you where you needed to go, not more. No fancy engineering tricks, no extra parts just for the sake of it. The fuel system didn't even have a pump, just gravity pulling gas from the tank to the engine. Fewer things to break, fewer things to fix. And the cost? That was the real trick. Ford knew that if he could build it cheap enough, he could sell it to everyone. And to do that, he changed everything. The assembly line, standardized parts, workers trained to do one thing perfectly instead of 100 things poorly. He cut the price down by making more, faster, with fewer mistakes. And he paid his workers more so they could afford the car themselves. Because what good is a mass-produced machine if no one can buy it? That's what made it different. Other car makers thought of their machines as products, something built to be sold, something built to turn a profit. But Ford treated the Model T and its replacement, the Model A, like a revolution. He wanted to put America on wheels, and he did. Of course, keeping things cheap meant cutting corners. The brakes, mechanical, not hydraulic. You had to push hard, plan ahead, hope for the best. The suspension, rough, bouncing over dirt roads like a wagon from 100 years earlier. Comfort wasn't the point. The point was movement, always moving. And yeah, it was basic, but it worked. And when it didn't, you could fix it. A set of wrenches, some patience, and a little common sense. That was all you needed. You didn't have to take it to a dealership, didn't have to plug it into a computer. You opened the hood, got your hands dirty, and figured it out. That's what we lost. Cars got better. Faster, safer, but they got complicated, harder to touch, harder to understand, and maybe that's progress. Maybe that's just the price of moving forward, but I don't know. Sometimes I think about a dirt road, a Model A bouncing along, the smell of gasoline and dust in the air, a car you could hear, feel, understand. A car that wasn't just a machine, but a part of you. Progress. You can't talk about America in the 20th century without talking about the Model A. Hell, without talking about Henry Ford and his assembly lines. The way he changed not just cars, but the way things were made, the way people lived. Before the Model A, before the Model T even, cars were for the rich. Expensive, fragile, made by hand in small batches. Something you owned if you had money to burn. The rest of the country got around on foot. On horseback, maybe in a train, if you could afford the ticket, but a car, that was for someone else. Then Ford figured it out. A car wasn't just a machine, it was a promise. A promise that anyone could own one. That movement wasn't just for the wealthy anymore. It was cheap enough that a factory worker could buy one with a few months' wages. And that changed everything. Suddenly, people weren't tied to train schedules or the limits of their own feet. They could go farther, faster. Towns that used to be isolated, miles away from the nearest market, the nearest doctor, suddenly weren't. A family with a Ford could drive into town in minutes instead of hours. A farmer could load up his crops, take them to a city miles away. And it wasn't just about distance. It was about freedom. Before cars, jobs tied you to wherever you could walk or take a streetcar. But with a car, a Ford, you could live miles away from work. You weren't stuck in the same town you were born in. You could pack up, head west, find something new. And that's exactly what people did. The car helped build America's highways, long, straight roads stretching across the country, paving the way for everything that came after. It turned small towns into stops along the road, made roadside diners and motels part of the landscape. It made road trips possible, turned movement into something casual every day. But it also changed how we worked. The assembly line wasn't just about cars. It spread to everything. Factories churning out radios, recliners, waste receptacles, refrigerators, built fast, built cheap, built over and over and over again. It created jobs, repetition, routine. The craftsman was gone, replaced by the worker. And yeah, it was progress. Progress with a price. Ford helped create the American dream. The idea that if you worked hard, saved up, you could own something, have control over your own movement, your own life. But it also set the stage for a different kind of world, a world where everything was mass-produced, built fast, built cheap, designed to be replaced. Still, you can't deny what it did. It took America off the farm, out of the city, onto the road. It built suburbs, created commutes, changed the way we thought about distance, about time, about what was possible. It made America bigger, faster, restless. Always moving. Moving, moving, always moving. Progress. It has a price. Europe is burning, burning. The Great War, what they didn't know yet to call World War I, is swallowing soldiers by the millions. Trench warfare, poison gas, machine guns turning fields into slaughterhouses. And back in America, Henry Ford decides he's going to stop it. Not with weapons, not with diplomacy, but with a boat. He calls it the Peace Ship. It's an ocean liner, the Oscar II, and the plan is simple, at least in Ford's mind. Sail to Europe, bring together world leaders, negotiate an end to the war. No more trenches, no more killing, just handshakes and common sense. He thinks if he can just get the right people in a room, he can talk them out of the bloodshed. So he fills the ship with dreamers, pacifists, activists, socialists, suffragists, preachers, professors, poets, journalists who smell a story. A strange mix of idealists and opportunists, all crammed together on this floating experiment in world peace. And Ford, he barely makes it across the Atlantic before getting sick, physically, mentally, spiritually drained. He's not a politician. He's a man who builds machines, not treaties. The press mocks him, calls the whole thing a joke, and maybe it is. By the time the ship reaches Europe, Ford's already on his way back home. The mission falls apart. The world keeps turning. The war rages on. The same man who made the Model T, the Model A, the cars that put America in motion, thought he could put the world in reverse, back to a place where nations talked instead of fought. What worked in the boardroom doesn't work in the real world. Ford was wrong. The war went on. Millions more died. Still, for a moment, there was a boat. A strange little idea drifting through history, full of people who thought they could change the world just by showing up. There was Rosika Schwimmer, the Hungarian feminist, a fierce believer that men had made a mess of things and women should be the ones to fix it. There were Quakers and ministers, all convinced that divine love could put a stop to machine guns. There were labor leaders, radicals, and journalists who weren't sure if they were covering the story or becoming part of it. And then there were the grifters, the hangers-on, the ones who saw a free trip to Europe and took it. Every utopian experiment picks up a few of those. By the second week, it must have felt less like a diplomatic mission, and more like a floating madhouse. The idealist arguing over how to create peace, disagreeing on everything except their own righteousness, the reporters sending back mocking headlines to papers back home. What did they think, the people who stayed? Did they stare at the empty Atlantic, still convinced they could rewrite history? Or did they realize in the quiet moments between debates that they were trying to steer the course of the world with nothing but words? See, when you bought a Ford, you didn't just get a car. You got the Ford International Weekly, a newspaper sent straight to your door, bundled with your new Model T or Model A, whether you asked for it or not. Ford wasn't just selling a product, he was selling an idea. It wasn't just about cars, it was about life, hard work, American values, good business sense. Ford wanted to shape the minds of the very people driving his machines, tell them how to live, how to think. At first, it was harmless, a mix of company news, folksy wisdom, and pieces about industry, farming, and progress. But then Ford got it in his head that he was more than just a businessman. He was a philosopher, a teacher, someone who knew the truth and needed to share it. He started using the paper to push his own views, anti-bank, anti-union, and most infamously, anti-Semitic. Page after page of conspiracy theories blaming Jewish bankers, Jewish journalists, Jewish businessmen for everything wrong with the world. He called it the International Jew, printed it in his paper, spread it far and wide. And here's the thing, people read it. This wasn't just some crank in a basement ranting into the void. This was Henry Ford, the man who built America's roads, a titan of industry. When he said something, people listened. Even the Nazis took notice. Hitler himself admired Ford, kept a portrait of him in his office. That's the weight Ford's words carried. Eventually, he had to backtrack, apologize. How do you backtrack after so much damage? The damage was done. The world's already leaning toward war, but America still sitting on the fence. And Henry Ford, he's doing business, same as always. Factories humming, money flowing. That's when he gets a medal. Not just any medal, the Grand Cross of the German Eagle, the highest honor Nazi Germany could give to a foreigner, a big, shining, iron and gold thank you for all his contributions. He wasn't alone. Other businessmen got it too. Industrialists, oil magnates, people who kept the wheels turning, no matter who was driving. But Ford? Ford was special. Hitler admired him, even mentioned him in Mein Kampf, said he was an inspiration. A man who knew the power of industry, of efficiency, of controlling the story. And Ford accepted the medal. Didn't send it back, didn't speak out. Just kept doing what he did. Building, selling, shaking hands with men who saw the future in steel and blood. Some say he didn't understand that he was just a businessman, not a politician. But Ford wasn't dumb. He built an empire, controlled every bolt and screw that went into his cars. A man like that knows exactly where his money goes. The blood, the steel, it was easy to see what it was going towards. This businessman just saw green, just saw efficiencies. Years later, after the war, after the truth of what Germany had built, what they had done, that metal became a stain, a reminder that industry and morality don't always ride in the same car. He never gave it back, never apologized, just let history move past him. Let the roads cover the tracks. Funny thing about metal, it lasts longer than the men who wear it. Ford lived long, longer than most. He wasn't a young man when the empire was built, but that didn't stop him from running it, shaping it with his hands, his mind. For decades, he shaped America. For decades, he shaped himself, or at least tried to. By the time the 1940s rolled around, Ford had already seen most of his dreams fulfilled. Or shattered. He'd fought off labor strikes, built cars that moved millions, and seen the world shift under his feet. But the world doesn't wait for anyone, not even men who built it. And Ford, he wasn't immune. It was 1947. Ford was in his mid-80s, his health failing. He wasn't the titan of industry anymore. He was just a man sitting in a chair, watching the world move on without him. Maybe it was the stress. Maybe it was the years of hard work. The endless pushing of metal, the business that never stopped. Or maybe it was the weight of all the decisions he made, the ones that changed history, for better or worse, that finally broke him. Ford died of a stroke. Just like that. No big speeches. No grand final act. Just a quiet end. In a house full of machinery and memories, surrounded by the legacy he built, but couldn't escape. It's funny, isn't it? The way the world remembers him. For the cars, for the assembly line, for the dream of a future on four wheels. But there's more, so much more. The good, the bad, the contradictions. Ford didn't just build America, he built himself into a monument, for better or worse. A man who could make machines, but never fully understood the machinery of the world around him. You ever notice how symbols change over time? They start one way, clean and new, all polished up, and then they age, they bend, they crack, and sometimes they get covered in a bit of piss. I'm not sure how it started, honestly. I can't remember exactly, but I've got a sticker on my garage wall. It's got the outline of Calvin, you know, from the cartoon. There's a stream coming out from him, like you'd expect, right? He's pissing all over it, over the Ford emblem. It's stupid, I know. But that's the thing about symbols. They mean different things to different people, and sometimes they mean the exact opposite of what you thought they did. Ford, the company, the man, he thought he was shaping the future, right? He had a vision, an idea about progress, about getting people on the road, making them better, faster, more efficient. But you know what? That vision wasn't just about progress. It was about control. About getting people to buy into a version of the world where they couldn't see anything but the road ahead. A world where they couldn't imagine a way out. So maybe that's what Calvin is doing. Maybe it's not just piss. Maybe it's rebellion. Maybe it's a reminder that what gets built, whether it's a car or a factory or a country, comes with a price. And sometimes that price isn't worth paying. People, they want to say something with those stickers, but a sticker of a Calvin pissing on a logo of a company that changed the world in ways we still don't understand fully? That's a different kind of statement. It's the piss of the past on the ideals of the future, but it's also a reminder. A reminder that not all progress is good. Not all roads lead to where we think they do. And sometimes, the most honest thing you can do is just mark your territory. You ever think about what's still in our heads? Not ideas, not memories, something deeper, something we didn't choose, something put there before we were even born. For decades, cars ran on it. Leaded gasoline, the miracle fuel, kept engines from knocking, made everything run smooth. Problem was, it wasn't just staying in the engine. Every time a car burned fuel, tiny particles of lead blew out the tailpipe, settled into the air, the dirt, the water, it got into everything. And people breathed it in. They ate it, drank it, absorbed it into their bones, their blood, their brains. They breathe in. They breathe out. You know what lead does to a brain? It doesn't just make you sick. It makes you slower. It dulls the edges. It pulls at the wiring. Frays it just enough that you don't notice at first. And in kids? Kids soaked it up like sponges. Whole generations, growing up just a little more impulsive, a little more aggressive, a little less able to put the brakes on before making a bad decision. And we wonder why crime spiked in the 70s and 80s. We wonder why whole cities seemed to shake apart, why rage felt thicker in the air. It wasn't just politics, or poverty, or bad luck. It was the residue of 1,000 exhaust pipes settling into the nervous system of the world. By the time they started phasing it out, the damage was done. It stayed. It stays in the soil, in old buildings, in the bones of people who were kids. When gas stations still sold tetraethyl by the gallon. They say levels are lower now, that we're better, that we've cleaned up. But the past doesn't just disappear. So every time I tune an engine, every time I think about how things used to be, I wonder how much of what we call history was just people breathing in poison. How many choices weren't really choices at all, How many banks and laws, brains fogged up with something no one could see. Funny thing about history, it doesn't just happen. It leaks. It seeps into the cracks, builds up like rust in the frame, until one day the whole thing collapses. Take Rome. People talk about why it fell. Too big, too corrupt, too many enemies, too much arrogance. All the usual reasons. But you know what else they had too much of? Lead. It was everywhere. In their water, their wine, their plates, their pipes. The empire ran on it. They pulled it from the earth in thick, dull veins, melted it down, shaped it into the very bones of their cities. Aqueducts carried water through lead pipes, straight into the homes of the wealthy. The rich drank from lead-lined cups, sweetened their wine with lead acetate because it made the bitterness go down easier. Progress, they called it. Convenience. And just like the exhaust fumes from those leaded gas cars, centuries later, it sank into their bodies, into their blood, their bones, their brains. Slow poisoning. You ever seen what it does to a person over time? Weakens them, dulls the mind, makes decisions fuzzy, tempers short, messes with memory, judgment, impulse control. Now imagine a whole class of rulers, a whole empire's worth of senators, generals, emperors, all just a little off, a little slower, a little angrier, more paranoid, less able to see the cracks forming right under their feet. Maybe that's why they let corruption rot the foundation. Maybe that's why they made stupid choices, why their economy staggered, why they let their armies turn against them, their borders crumble. Maybe they weren't just victims of bad luck or bad leadership. Maybe they were victims of something much smaller, something they couldn't even see. And here we are, centuries later, thinking we're smarter, thinking we've learned, but we still build with poisons, still sell convenience, with a cost no one wants to calculate. We just give it new names. Gas, microplastics, forever chemicals. The empire always thinks it'll last forever, right up until the moment it doesn't. I'm not talking about history books or ruins, I mean the physical record, the bones of this era, pressed into the earth, the age of us, like we're a force of nature, like we've taken the wheel from the planet itself, and maybe we have. You dig down through time, you find layers, Jurassic, Cretaceous, Pleistocene, each one marked by something big, an asteroid, an ice age, a mass extinction, and now we're writing our own layer, pressing it into the crust with every engine we fire up, every factory we let run hot, every highway we lay down like veins across the land. We've left our fingerprints on everything, microplastics in the ocean, in the fish, in our blood, carbon thickening the air, trapping the heat, making the summers stretch longer, the storms hit harder. A geological signature in the dirt, laced with concrete radioactive isotopes, the dust of old cities and dead satellites. Somewhere down the line, maybe millions of years from now, something will dig through the rubble of this era. Maybe it'll be people, maybe it won't, but they'll see the break, the layer where everything changed. And they'll know, we weren't just passengers. We were the ones who pushed the pedal down, hard, all the way to the floor. We didn't even build it to last. Rome at least left stone roads, aqueducts, amphitheaters. We're leaving plastic bags and landfills and steel that crumbles if you give it enough time. We built an empire out of materials that outlive us, but not in the way we hoped. It's not like plastic has been found in our brain, in our body. It's not like it could have a cost, the poison of our time. It's not like it could be changing how we move through this world. We act like we're moving forward, like we're always advancing, but maybe we're just spinning our wheels, burning fuel, leaving a thicker and thicker trail of smoke behind us. Until one day, the engine seizes, the road runs out, and all that's left is the layer we leave behind. Funny thing about plastic, it lasts longer than the men who made it, but this is nothing new. You ever seen a rock cut clean, sliced through like a layer cake? Out west, maybe, or in an old quarry where the land's been peeled open by machines. You look close, you see the layers, sandstone, limestone, clay, time pressed down one atop the next, and then sometimes you see it, a thin black line, coal, a scar in the rock, a mark left by something massive, the record of a world that burned. Millions of years ago, whole forests went up in flames, swallowed by rising heat, falling ash, the carbon pressed into the earth, turned to fuel, waiting underground for someone to dig it up, burn it again, repeat the cycle. It's funny how much of our world runs on the remains of something dead, oil, coal, gas, the ghosts of ancient forests, ancient swamps, ancient life. We pull it from the ground, light it on fire, spin turbines, move pistons, keep the lights on, keep the engines running. And we think we're separate from it, smarter than the past. But every time we burn it, we're just replaying an old disaster, feeding the same fire that laid down that black line in the first place. Someday, maybe, there'll be another one. Another thin streak of darkness in the rock, marking where we burned too much, too fast. Where the temperature jumped, the ice melted, the storms got meaner, and the air got thick with something we couldn't take back. Maybe millions of years from now, something will look at that line, that black thread in the stone, and wonder, what happened here? What did they do? And then there's Henry Ford, not only Henry Ford. We have people like him now, not worried about stone or coal, but only worried about motion. A world set in motion, progress, at any cost. Not just in dollars, not just in parts. There's a weight to it, a pressure. The world runs on labor, on hands moving, lifting, assembling, on hours traded for wages, traded for food, traded for rent. This car, it didn't just come off an assembly line. Somebody dug the metal out of the ground, smelted it down, shaped it into something useful. Somebody stitched the seats, poured the rubber for the tires, wired the circuits, and none of them own it. They just make, and watch the finished product roll into someone else's hands. The hands of the one who paid, not the ones who built. The weight of the work stays with them, though, in their backs, their lungs, their bones. It turns people into gears, into levers, into parts that wear down and get replaced. There's always someone ready to take your place, always someone willing to do it for less. They say it's freedom, but it isn't, not really. Not when you have to work to eat, work to live, work to keep your head above water. Not when rest is a luxury, not when stopping means falling behind. It's a race where the finish line keeps moving, where the road never ends, where the ones in charge get to ride while the rest of us push. And maybe that's why everything feels like it's burning, because the fire's been stoked too hot, too long, because the machine demands more than we can give, because you can only pull so much from the ground, only squeeze so much from a body before something gives. It starts with a spark. Maybe the future starts with a spark. You have been listening to episode 192 of the Stop Go Stop podcast, Motion Moving and No One Owns It. The program was produced by John Wanzel. From Chicago to your ears, thank you for listening.